Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening.
Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm currently in Berlin about to address the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Anniversary Conference on Chernobyl. I can give you now an update on what's happening at the catastrophe at Fukushima. There are various reports. One report said in The Guardian 3 days ago that there had been a complete meltdown at reactor number two, that the fuel had melted its way in a molten lavel mass through the containment vessel onto the concrete floor, and there was a risk that there could be a massive hydrogen explosion similar to the one at Chernobyl. That has not happened. Now, a second report 2 days ago printed in the New York Times reported that the Department of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu in America said that reactor number one had had a 70% meltdown, 7-0, that reactor two had had a 33% meltdown. These are all guesstimates. Nobody really knows because none of the equipment and instruments have been hooked up to the electricity supply, so they're blind men staggering around in the dark. There's also evidence, apparently, coming from American engineers who are in Japan at the moment monitoring the situation, that very, very high levels of radiation have escaped, probably from one of the fuel pools, number four, on top of the number four reactor, when there was a hydrogen explosion, and that very, very radioactive bits and pieces are being found on the ground between the reactors, and they're trying to cover that up with resin and with bitumen. Also, very, very radioactive material has been found some distance from the plant. In other words, it seems when there was a hydrogen explosion which ruptured the roof of the fuel rod pool, that parts of the fuel rods escaped. Now, these fuel rods are extremely radioactive. The short-lived radioactive elements have decayed. 50% of the elements in these fuel rods is cesium-137, which is a deadly radioactive element, which, if getting into the body, it bioconcentrates in food and can cause brain cancers and cancers in many organs. It also lasts for 600 years. The other 50% of the material in the fuel pool is long-lived isotopes such as plutonium, which is absolutely deadly, and its relatives such as curium, neptunium, einsteinium, americium, and the like. Strontium-90 is also in these cooling pools, and many other long-lived isotopes. Now, there's another factor that is happening in reactor one. The TEPCO has measured 13 instances of neutron flux, about 1.5 K from the reactor itself. Neutron flux indicates that a fission process is occurring within the reactor. It's not a cold shutdown. That means that in pockets in the reactor core, there's fissioning going on. Now, why would that happen? Fissioning occurs in the presence of water. They're pouring water into the reactor, and apparently it is accumulating in small pockets in the damaged fuel rods, causing fissioning. Neutrons are extremely dangerous, much, much more dangerous than X-rays and gamma radiation, which are similar. They go straight through the body. They go straight through cement, concrete, steel, and they travel kilometres. So the men working at the reactor will inevitably if they're within the neutron beam when it happens, be exposed to very, very high levels of radiation. One mother said her son knows that he will die. This is very tragic. If there is a major explosion at one of the reactors, a la Chernobyl, then all the workers will have to evacuate and there will be no one to tend to the dilapidated and deteriorating fuel pools and reactor cores. God knows what will happen after that. The evacuation zones are up to 20K now, I think, or 30K, but they're not big enough. Radiation has been found in the drinking water in Tokyo, radioactive iodine. If that's there, cesium-137 will be there and other isotopes. The noble gases, krypton, xenon and argon, are not being measured at all. They're not measuring for alpha radiation, which is plutonium and its relatives, americium and the like, which is they're deadly, deadly radioactive elements. Alpha radiation, when inside the body, radiates just a tiny volume of cells and inevitably will induce cancer years later. So we're talking about a catastrophe that no one knows when it will end, if it indeed ever will. The Japanese Prime Minister said it could go on for months or indeed years. This is the biggest nuclear tragedy ever to have occurred on Earth, apart from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and no one knows where it will end. If there is a major meltdown and the winds blowing towards the south, much of Japan will be contaminated for virtually the rest of time. If the wind's blowing from east to west across the Pacific, the North American continent, and indeed much of the Northern Hemisphere will be contaminated. So that's where the situation stands at the moment. And now we will go back to our regular programming.
My guest today is Lexi Schultz. Lexi is the Legislative Director for the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program. In that role, she advocates for practical, science-based solutions for climate change while helping to translate climate science data and information for Washington decision-makers and the general public. She's been actively engaged in helping to shape federal climate and energy policy in Congress and works with an extensive coalition of organisations and grassroots activists. She's testified before House and Senate committees on a number of environmental issues and served on the National Advisory Council for the Environmental Policy and Technology Superfund Subcommittee to advise the EPA on the future of the Superfund program. Lexi Schultz joins us now on the phone. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Lexi.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Yes. Well, things are in a state of chaos, aren't they?
In the U.S. Congress, they certainly are.
Well, and that the U.S. Congress sort of sets the pattern in a certain sense for the rest of the world. Why don't you walk us through exactly what this new Republican Congress is up to in terms of the environment?
Sure. Well, one thing that's happening in Congress right now is that they're debating a spending bill to keep our federal government and all its programs in operation for the rest of our fiscal year. And this is a big deal because it funds everything, but especially the environmental and energy, air, water, climate programs. And as part of this spending bill, the new House Republican leadership and some of the freshman members have decided to take massive, massive cuts to most of the programs that would keep our air clean and our water clean and help us moving forward on climate change in the U.S. In addition to that, they've attached all kinds of legislative provisions that really should have nothing to do with spending that would block action on climate change and on many clean water programs. So the House, the U.S. House of Representatives just passed this bill, and it would really truly be devastating for environmental programs. And now the issue goes to the Senate, and it's a little bit unclear what happens next.
Yes. Well, what my question is if the House passes all of this, has it already voted on it, Lexi?
On this bill, they voted on it and the House has passed it.
Yeah. Now, so what power does the Senate have over something that the House has passed that's absolutely irresponsible? Does it have to go line item by line item, or can it, you know, say this bill is absolutely incongruous in Congress and we've got to veto the whole bill? How does it work?
The Senate can actually start brand new. They can do their own version of a bill like this. So they can write it all over again, have more money for all of these programs, avoid all of these legislative provisions, and pass something entirely different. But then the problem is that the Senate would need 60 votes out of our 100 Senate membership in order to pass a bill. And right now, that would mean that both Democrats and some Republicans would have to vote for that package. And in addition, whatever the Senate passes has to be ultimately combined with the House version in such a fashion as that the House would pass it again.
What a mess. Now, what about the president? I suppose the Senate has to do its thing, and then the Senate and Congress have to get together and work out what to do, and then it has to go to the president for signature. Is that right?
That's right. In order to pass any final legislation, once the House and Senate have actually agreed on a bill, then the president would have to sign it. In this particular case, what's happening is that the President Obama has issued a veto threat over the House bill, which means if the bill were to land on his desk looking like it did when it passed the House, he would veto and they would have to start all over again.
Well, why doesn't the Senate just leave it as is and just pass it over to the president to veto?
Well, the stakes are fairly high in this particular situation because our government is set to shut down on March 4th unless something is passed.
That's because they've blocked supply, have they? What?
That's because there was never a spending bill actually completed last year.
Oh, my God.
What they did was say we're going to keep our government running at 2010 spending levels until March 4th of this year. And
that was
the
Democrats that did that, right?
That's right.
That was a silly thing to do. Why?
Part of the reason they did that is because it is so challenging to get agreement in the U.S. Senate. It's reasonably evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, and some of the Democrats are quite conservative on a number of, in particular, environmental issues and other social issues, as well as fiscal issues. And they never could get agreement. It was an election year. Things got very political. And so they put it off until this year. And, of course, since that time, we've had an election and the politics have changed. And so now we're in this situation. In theory, the House leadership, the Republicans, the Senate leadership, the Democrats, and the president have all said that they would like to avoid a government shutdown, which, as you might imagine, would have all kinds of consequences. All of our national parks would close down. Our clean water programs would go without enforcement. There would be all kinds of programs to aid children, health programs. Everything would have to stop unless it was absolutely critical for national security. And those are some pretty high stakes. So there is a possible path forward if the House were to come back. Right now, both the House and Senate are in what they call a recess, which means they're back home in their districts. And when they come back next week, they have 1 week for the House and Senate to pass something that they might agree on. Right now, what's happening is the House is saying, we're willing to pass something a little bit short-term in order to get agreement on the larger package, but the short-term vehicle would also have to take massive budget cuts to some of the same programs. And the Senate is saying, we'd like to do something short-term and to negotiate it, but we just can't tolerate some of these devastating cuts. So right now, things are at an impasse. There's some thought that they will continue to try to work something out, But frankly, all that would do is push the debate further down the line. And ultimately, this is going to come down to a debate about whether the Republican leadership in the House is really going to force programs that would really devastate some key programs, and for the environment in particular, programs that are absolutely critical for clean air and clean water, down Americans' throats in the name of cutting the budget. And that's really what it comes down to.
But I don't understand. Supply can be cut off shortly, but why is it dependent upon this bill? Is this bill that cuts all the spending? It's just I read all the programs they're going to cut. It's absolutely unbelievable. So is this bill really enfolded into government spending that they pass on to the Senate, and if the Senate passes it, then it's okay, you can go for another year without a shutdown. Is that right?
Well, what it would do, if they can actually come to some sort of agreement on the bigger package, this would keep us going just through the end of September.
Oh, and then what happens?
Well, they are already supposed to be working on the spending bill for the year after that. And in essence, these same debates will happen for that bill.
This is ridiculous. It's absolute chaos. I mean, I can't imagine with these, you know, Tea Partiers who virtually know nothing, and I'm saying that advisedly and carefully about science and what has to happen to save the planet, which is in gross jeopardy at the moment. I mean, I can't see it ever being resolved, Lexi.
I have to say, I think it is really challenging to see a resolution on this. I'll tell you right now that these budget cuts, in addition to being devastating, as you said, for the planet, will have real consequences in the districts of each of the members who are voting on them. And I think, I mean, certainly we are trying to point out what some of these consequences are.
Like,
our focus is most particularly around climate change and what it means for energy. But frankly, they're cutting programs for example, to help low-income residents have access to energy efficiency programs to lower their heating.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Yes.
Next one.
and we they're also cutting programs for wastewater treatment plants. So, you know, to help treat sewage along, you know, in many, many towns and rural areas and coastal areas around the country. They're cutting programs that would reduce the pollution that causes smog and soot and leads to all kinds of respiratory illness and increases hospitalizations, particularly in cities, but really all across America. And these are the sorts of consequences that we're trying to point out. And at the end of the day, every member of Congress, sort of Tea Party ideology aside, has to be elected by their own constituents in their own districts.
Yeah, but it's going to take a while for these cuts to manifest themselves in local communities. Like if you're not sorting out the sewage properly, And people's electricity bills go up because the efficiency programs haven't been instituted, it's going to take quite a long time for the constituents to wake up and say, what on earth is going on? What have you done to us?
Well, it's an education issue.
I mean,
it's up to groups like ours, you know, certainly on from our standpoint on climate and energy and the environment, and other groups in America who care about health issues and so forth, to really raise these issues before the local media, you know, the media in these towns and districts and everything else, so that the consequences are understood before it's too late.
Yeah,
really,
but
what it comes,
Lexi, that's a huge task. Having once kind of helped to organize a grassroots movement in America on nuclear weapons in the 80s, my God, it's an enormous task. Have you got the people and the communities to be able to do this? I mean, this is ginormous.
Well, I won't dispute you on how large a task this is. I will say that because this particular spending bill cuts so broadly, there is a very large constituency against these measures. We have the U.S. labor movement. We have the entire public health community in America. We have groups coming out in various cities who are just up in arms.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the state political protests have made their way onto your radar screen, but there are protests going on right now in a number of Midwest states around what the governors are doing around budget cuts. And tens of thousands of people have been turning out to the local state houses around issues particularly related to how it would affect the workers' movement. So these issues are not simply limited to the federal government, and it is getting a huge amount of attention. People are really up in arms over this. Whether we can... you know, whether we will be successful is obviously unknown at this point. But I will tell you, people are willing to fight with everything they have because this really does, this bill, if it were to pass or something similar to it, really would be devastating for quite a number of environmental programs.
I'm interviewing Lexi Schultz, who is the Legislative Director for the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program. Lexi, I read the New York Times and Washington Post every day to keep up with things, and sometimes the Huffington Post, although since she sold it to AOL, I'm not so keen to go to the Huffington Post. But tomorrow, apparently, there is going to be a huge turnout at the capitals in many states protesting the cuts, particularly to the union movement.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little about that? Of course, this will be old news once this program is broadcast, but what is predicted, Lexi, and what exactly are they protesting about, and how many do they expect, and in what capitals?
So what's happened at the state level is that many state governments are also facing budget deficits. And in several Midwest states in particular, where there are currently Republican governors, the way they're approaching these budget cuts is to say that they need to cut the ability for unions of government workers, and this includes everything from teachers to police officers to the sanitation workers, that they should lose their rights to bargain for wages, benefits, and so forth. Essentially, undercutting not just money, but undercutting the specific rights that are integral to the labor movement here. And this started in Wisconsin, and there was a bill just passed one of the chambers in Wisconsin, and the Senate Democrats who opposed this actually left the state in order to prevent a vote from being completed on a bill to take away those labor rights. But the governor is not giving up, and in response, the labor movement started turning out thousands of people at the Wisconsin Capitol. Since that time, other governors have indicated that they're looking at doing similar things, and it has become something of a national issue. You have the labor movement on the one side, and environmental groups and others have joined forces with the labor movement because essentially what's happening is it's clear that the Republican governors are seeing these budget cuts as a way to implement long-standing conservative social policy. And in response to that, you have some right-wing groups, in particular funded by the Koch brothers, who are big supporters of right-wing movements in this country, funding conservative protests all around the country.
Like Rent-A-Crowd.
Yes, exactly. And so it's become a national issue. It's expanded much beyond Wisconsin. And I think it's being seen as something of a referendum on whether the budget cuts become more about implementing conservative social policy.
But isn't it interesting that, Lexi, that the people of America voted in these extraordinarily conservative, some of them out to lunch Republicans, but now they're protesting because they're starting to realize what these characters are up to. I suppose it's because many people see in Australia, voting is compulsory. We all have to vote or you get fined. I suppose it's because many people stayed at home, thought, I'm not going to vote now. It's a midterm. I don't get out to midterm elections. And anyway, I'm not so pleased with Obama. And, you know, I just will sit this one out. My God, they must be rueing the day that they did that.
Well, I think that that's certainly part of the situation. There's also a real divide in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You continue to have the Tea Party movement, who not only are not ruining these budget cuts, but are reveling in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that is you have more of a progressive movement in this country who didn't elect these folks at all.
Mm-hmm.
And are really quite upset. And then you have a group in the middle that call themselves independents that really will vote in an individual election on one issue or another. Maybe they were unhappy about the health care bill that was passed, and that's what they voted on. And, you know, not understanding the kind of full consequences of what might happen down the line. And so, you know, you really have a split in this country. And as you mentioned, you have a certain number of people who just sit it out altogether and who don't think that they can make a difference and engage in policy and politics. And obviously, you can tell from the tone of my voice, I think that's a mistake. I think every person in this country has a role to play, but it doesn't always pan out that way.
Well, I know, but, you know, you have a responsibility if you live in a democracy. You know, use it or lose it. And if you don't get out there and vote, and more than voting, participate in legislation and know what's going on and educate your representatives, you don't have a democracy in the end, do you? And that's what I can see sort of being pushed by the Koch brothers. I mean, I can't understand how what they're doing is legal in your country, Lexi.
Well, the issue of corporate funding and massive, you know, wealthy donors contributing to political campaigns is certainly an issue that has come up over and over and over again. We passed a campaign finance reform bill that would have taken tiny little baby steps towards trying to limit some of this money in politics, and ultimately our Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional, that you can't limit spending money in political campaigns or issue campaigns because that's tantamount to limiting free speech. There's a big divide on that issue. Many people are up in arms over that Supreme Court case, but for right now, that is the law of the land, and that means that there's a certain amount of impunity with some of these very, very wealthy donors trying to affect and actually having a big effect on our politics.
It's so interesting, Lexi, though, isn't it, that the demonstrations in Wisconsin, which I've always loved as a very progressive state, the Athens of America, followed just after the Egypt Revolution. And I saw a sign in Egypt, one of the demonstrators holding it up saying, Egypt supports Wisconsin.
That's fabulous.
And it feels like, you know, the movement for freedom and individual liberty and for moral leadership is spreading. And do you have a feeling, Lexi, that in America people are starting to get the message that this ain't good enough and that we'd better get involved? And as well as just the unions being involved now, as you mentioned, you've got the environmental movements and the healthcare movements and everything. Are they really starting to join up seriously?
Yes. I mean, I would say that the kind of separate progressive movements have joined up in at a level that is really unprecedented. I think some of this is because of the realization of how the Tea Party movement, the right-wing movements in this country, have capitalized on social media and organizing tools in their own right, and recognizing that the progressive side of things, I think, had grown complacent.
Mm.
There were lots of groups that thought that they had a kind of a lock on organizing, and it doesn't work that way. And as we've seen in Egypt and in other places around the world, the internet and internet organizing has really changed some of the dynamics for some of these efforts.
And you think that's working well? You think the Tea Party has used that, but now you think the other side's starting to get going on this now?
Yes, exactly. I mean, as part of the environmental movement, I can say that we've definitely been using some of these organizing tools, but I don't think there was a full understanding just exactly what the other side was bringing to bear.
Yeah.
And now I think that this election really was a wake-up call on that front.
Yeah, well, I've got to start to learn to Twitter now, because we want to Twitter the radio program, but also I set up a website called nuclearfreeplanet.org, because I wanted specifically to get to the youth who are, you know, they don't tend to read much these days, nor watch TV news, but they Twitter all day and Facebook and the like. And so how do you get to this generation younger than 30? So I set that up specifically. But boy, they're way ahead of us. And if we could bring in that younger generation, X, Y, and Z, into understanding what's actually going on, that'd be a powerful force, wouldn't they, Lexi?
Absolutely. And I will say that certainly on the progressive side of things, many of the universities in this country are really engaged. I think the students in many cases have been trying to be more organized. There is a movement called Power Shift in this country, which is essentially a body that helps university students who are really just, you know, so eager to be engaged, and helps provide training and bring them in. And as you say, this is the entity that really will be the lifeblood of any organizing for the future. I mean, you see it around the world. It's really the youth movement that makes the difference.
Well, youth always lead revolutions. It's always the youth. And women, may I say. And the women get written out of history.
Yeah.
Now, I want to move on, Lexi, because you are an environmentalist, into what's your opinion or judgment of how much these Congress people understand about ozone depletion, global warming, toxic pollution, health of people and the environment. What's their understanding, would you say? And you can block it off into the very right-wing Tea Partiers and then the normal Republicans and then the Democrats and the Blue Dogs and the whole thing. What's their understanding or level of education and knowledge, Lexi?
I mean, I would say on scientific issues and environmental issues, in no small part, there's very little understanding.
Well, this is devastatingly frightening.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
I mean, I will say that I attend hearings, in Congress all the time, and this is where you hear members of Congress make their opening speeches before witnesses testify, and you then have them ask questions. And I do think that there are some members that are willfully denying climate science, for example, that they're doing it because they have fossil fuel interests that they're trying to back up.
Yes, same old story.
Yes. But in many cases, there is really truly just a sort of ignorance about what the situation is. Even the most basic understanding of what it means for the international scientific community to have reached a rough consensus about the fact that climate change is happening and we're already feeling its impact. And even in some cases, members who are not ideologically opposed to the sorts of environmental action, climate action that we would like to see, they just don't really understand the urgency. They don't really kind of get what it is that we're saying and why this isn't something that you can just defer forever. And that's what a group like the Union of Concerned Scientists is up against and is working against. We actually were just at a hearing in the House of Representatives Science Committee, where there was a member of the U.S. administration. This is the president's science advisor.
John Holdren,
yes. He was testifying about the president's preferred budget for science issues. And he came under quite a bit of attack and questioning on climate science. And we were tweeting about the hearing. That was a first experience for me in trying to tweet live like that, trying to get the information out about the disinformation on climate science. And at the same time, we had scientists who were in the room or watching the hearing who were able to then provide staff with the information about what was said was wrong. And these are staff for members who are more sympathetic to climate action. And so there's going to be a process of trying to educate some of the members who might be open to hearing this information.
You mean some have absolutely closed ears? They won't listen.
I think that's right. I've seen some interesting studies about why it is that the climate denier movement, if you will, is so politicized in this country, why it's got such traction more than, say, in Europe. And part of it is because it's become completely identified with a political party. So by and large, if you're a Republican in this country, you're not supposed to accept climate science. It's completely unnecessary. It's totally unfortunate, but it's gotten to such a point that there are Republicans who used to be open to hearing about climate science, who used to accept that climate change was real, that we needed to do something about it, who are backtracking in order to prove their Republican bona fides. So the new chair of the House Science Committee, Ralph Hall, who's from Texas, has been a big supporter of our space program, has supported science from that reason. He used to have information on his website about global warming. And when he ran, he had to actually run and compete in order to be the Science Committee chairman. He had to disavow all of that in order to win amongst his Republican colleagues.
But now he's won. He's got the power.
He's got the power, but he feels like he is under a very tight leash from the far right. And he, unfortunately, was one of the members in the Science Committee who was up there questioning climate science.
Oh, my God.
Attacking John Holdren on this.
What a hypocrite.
So, it's really a backtracking. And this politicization of climate science really has the potential to completely undo the progress that the Obama administration is trying to make on climate change. So that's part of what we're up against. One of the things I think is very clear is that it's very difficult for these members of Congress who want to deny the science to actually find the people to come up to the Hill to support their views. And that's really what we want to hammer on. We have a wide network of scientists, of health experts, of economists.
Of course.
That we work with that, we're going to be bringing up on a constant basis to demonstrate just how much real uniformity there is amongst the academic community, the kind of experts on these issues, that something needs to be done about climate change.
Something needs to be done. I mean, by God, the permafrost is melting, which will release millions of tons of CO2 and methane into the environment as we speak. I mean, do you know what? First of all, I want to ask you, how did John Holdren go? He stood up well to questioning. Was he polite? Did he lose his temper?
He did not lose his temper. He is very polite. And he also he's very good at this because he understands where many of these members of Congress currently are in their understanding.
Yeah.
And he knows that he has an opportunity to try to educate, to try to calm the situation down. And he, of course, is a real expert on climate science. So he was able to hold his own in this hearing, to really be very rational and calm about saying, you know, there is very clear consensus that the administration really, you know, understands that investing in climate solutions is also about investing in U.S. jobs and investing in our energy future and our energy dependence. And many of these issues are very linked. So whatever you think about the climate science, you should absolutely believe in climate solutions.
Now, okay, so let's get back to John. I know John. I've worked with him and beside him for some years, and he's highly informed. But what worries me about John Holden is that he's for nuclear power, Lexi.
Well, I have not heard him personally speak about nuclear power.
No.
I know that in this administration, there is a fair amount of support for nuclear power.
From Chu.
Yes, yeah, certainly from the Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu. And in the State of the Union speech that President Obama made, he indicated that he would like to see what he was calling a clean energy standard, which essentially would require that that something like 80% of our electricity by the middle of the century would come from pretty much all sources that didn't produce carbon.
And nuclear power does.
Right. Well, from their standpoint, nuclear power, they're considering it a clean energy source.
These guys are totally out to lunch, let me tell you. I mean, speaking as a physician, clean energy, doesn't matter if people die of cancer and genetic disease for the rest of time from the radioactive waste getting into our food and water supplies forevermore, that's still classified as clean energy?
Well, and the Union of Concerned Scientists just released a report this week looking at all the subsidies that the nuclear power industry in the U.S. has received over time. And the conclusion of the report is that it would have been cheaper for the federal government to buy the power and redistribute it than it would have been for them to invest the money they did in the nuclear power industry.
Power from where?
From other sources. If they had just simply invested in, you know,
hydro,
buy our own electricity and make sure that people have access to free electricity, that would have been cheaper than investing in nuclear power plants. So,
who put that report out? Was it David Lochbaum?
Actually, it was Ellen Vanko, who is our nuclear energy manager.
How can one obtain that report, Lexi?
On our website, which is www.ucsusa.org.
I have to say that I've been associated with the Union of Concerned Scientists since Henry Kendall founded it way, way back, and Dan Ford. And you've been a notable organization standing and educating people about nuclear power. So I have to say that just now. But what you're doing about all the rest is so important. Tell me, they're cutting funding for the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change. Lexi?
That was one of the many, many budget cuts that was included in this House spending bill. And the rhetoric that went around the offering of this budget cut was about disinformation around climate science, around, you know, some sort of controlling international body. It was truly extreme rhetoric. And there's a classic example of a complete lack of understanding on what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change really means, and that for the scientists who participate in this, they're volunteers. You know, not only is this about ensuring that the world has access to the best science and that policymakers actually have access to science they can interpret and use, but that these are people who are volunteering their time, and they're some of the world's best climate scientists. And the money that the U.S. contributes, some of it goes to the body itself, but the rest of it just goes so that the U.S. scientists can actually travel to these meetings. And that's what they're cutting. And there was just a complete lack of understanding about just how idiotic it is to cut that very modest funding.
I'm interviewing Lexi Schultz, who's the Legislative Director for the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program. Lexi, this is a question that's philosophically worried me for a long, long, long time. Democracy means that you elect people from the community. So you get a sort of a mirror image in the Congress of where the people are in general. And in general, because of, I suppose, my Australian colleague Rupert Murdoch, and and in general, because of the media, which is totally irresponsible in most cases, people do not understand why ozone depletion increases the incidence of melanoma and skin cancer. They don't understand how global warming works, like, you know, how a car heats up in the sun and goes to, you know, 100 degrees Fahrenheit when it's sitting in the sun with all the windows closed, and that's what's happening to the planet. Right. They don't understand basic stuff. So the people in Congress are a mirror image of their community from which they come. Now, I have to say that I actually blame my colleagues, physicians and the scientists. They're so goddamn careful. They stay in their labs, even when I interview scientists. They don't like to step out of line in case of what their colleagues think, or that isn't quite right, or I can't extrapolate. And they don't step up to say, I have to teach the people what science has done to the planet, is doing, and how we can fix it, and how we can interpret what science has done to the planet. They stay encased in their labs. Oh, and their grants may be at stake. They might not get their grants. But really, it's us, the scientists, who have failed to teach the people of the Earth what applied science has done in a very derogatory, negative way, and what it means to, you know, it's like the planet, like a body. It's like me telling a patient they have this disease and these are the ramifications and this is the prognosis and these are the treatments. We do that with individual patients, but we don't step out to teach the body politic, and neither do the scientists involved. Would you like to comment on that sort of thesis, Lexi?
Well, certainly, I mean, you know the Union of Concerned Scientists, but for the people who don't know what we do, we've been working since we started more than 40 years ago to work with scientists and the scientific community to get them involved, to work with them on how to communicate science to a lay audience, to work with them to have the training in order to be able to speak to general audiences, the media, policymakers, and also to understand why that's important. But I've also heard over and over again just how challenging it is. Many scientists in this country, if they don't publish, if they step out of line, if they don't get the respect of their colleagues, it ruins some of their chances for advancement. And we see this play out sometimes when it's actually the most senior scientists who feel the most free to engage in this sort of work. But we also have a new network of young scientists. These are scientists at the grad school level, sometimes postdocs, who really understand this and who have been much more connected, probably because of social media, but who are really much more connected to this idea that they need to speak out. I don't think it's enough. I think more scientists really can and should speak out. We're trying to provide a forum for that. We certainly would welcome any scientist who wants to participate, and we can provide them the tools for how to do that. But I think it's going to be a combination of things. You could have every scientist in this country speaking out, and I still don't think that would be enough to break through to some of the sort of ignorance and, in some cases, willful ignorance that we're seeing.
Superstition, it feels like. It's almost like a religion to deny scientific knowledge.
And you also, I mean, I think that is right. There has been a real disinformation campaign about science waged by many industries in this country for their own financial gain. It was what we've seen with the tobacco industry,
yes,
who, of course, for many years convinced the public that smoking was not hazardous
yes.
to your health. We saw it with the chemical industry trying to deny any impacts from pesticides, and it's still going on with chemicals in plastics, for example.
Yes.
And
nuclear industry.
The nuclear industry, absolutely. And, of course, now the coal industry, the oil industry, and some of the major manufacturers who are actively funding think tanks and others to put out completely inaccurate information.
Lies.
About climate change.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
About how it's going to be devastating economically to try to address climate change, which has been shown time and again by economists and others not to be true.
Mm.
That climate science is all a hoax, which it's so clear at this point, you know, more than 95% of the world scientists have said that climate change has been caused by man, is having effects right now. And if you get 95% of the world scientists to agree to anything, that's pretty much as close to solid
yes.
fact as you could ever get.
Yes.
But they're actively out there putting out disinformation, and it's still going on.
We
saw it with the release of the stolen emails and what's known as ClimateGate.
Yeah.
You know, where they took the words of a few individual scientists and blew that up as if it fundamentally called into question the underlying science of climate.
So that was orchestrated. I didn't know it was orchestrated, Lexi.
It's really fundamentally about disinformation. Who was behind those stolen emails?
Yeah.
We still don't know. But it was very clear immediately afterwards that it was picked up by all of the climate deniers and completely disseminated through all the channels. And I will say also, you mentioned Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
One of the things that has absolutely happened in this country is that there has been a complete divide in the source where people get their information.
Mm.
So it's very clear that people are getting information only from what becomes an echo chamber for the views that they already hold.
Mm.
And so you have an entire body of people who only listen to Fox News and will only hear that. And unfortunately, Fox News, as I've mentioned, it's become this kind of right-wing thing to deny climate science. And it's gotten wrapped up and wrapped up and wrapped up. And it's very, very challenging for anyone to break through to that. So even our, you know, the most outspoken scientists who are really out there talking to the media, doing media interviews, who are talking with members of Congress, who are doing rounds of just kind of public meetings, it's very difficult for them to break through. I think one foot in that door, one wedge, is through some of the religious community in this country.
Mm.
There's obviously some of the religious community that's very tied up with the political right, but there's also a growing body of churches, synagogues, and sort of other religious movements, religious groups that understand about creation care, that they talk about stewardship of the earth, and this is something that is able to somewhat break through this divide that I'm talking about. And it's very important. I mean, these are people that in many cases would never listen to what would be considered an environmentalist. But they're able to hear it because it comes through a church. So, we're trying to think about ways, we're trying to work with those who can break through some of this divide. But I think, unfortunately, the scientists alone are not able to do that. But I don't want to dismiss the responsibility, I think, that you were talking about originally for scientists to tap into their citizen side as well. But it's very much about the doctors and about the health officials speaking out about this, because those are the people who really are seen as the go-to people for this. Those are the people that people understand
when they're sick.
Know what it means, right? when you're sick.
And yeah. So, well, what...
There's a growing movement of that, but really it needs to come much more to the fore.
What we need is an Al Gore-type film painting the medical effects to frighten everyone. And if people aren't frightened right now, both with the ever-present threat of nuclear war, let's be frank, but also about global warming, if they're not frightened about the consequences, they will be soon. And we need to paint that scenario in a very graphic way, the way I gave my lectures about dropping bombs. It made people cry and freaked them out and changed their lives that night. And they knew they had to work to get rid of the nuclear weapons. So now we've got to, you know, my colleagues, we need to actually get out on the stage in you know, grassroots movements, town hall meetings, all over the country. And the urgency is profound because, as you know, Lexi, and I know, and all the climate scientists know, things ain't very pretty and they're getting worse much faster than we actually realized.
That's right. All the science that we're learning about is showing that all the effects that were predicted are actually happening either sooner,
yep,
faster, or, you know, more profoundly than were ever predicted. And,
yeah,
and some of that is about the sort of cautious nature of the scientific community.
Yes.
They don't want to go to the worst case scenario, but
yes,
that's essentially what's happening, is we're proving the worst case scenario from all the earlier projections.
Well, Lexi, I'd like to work with you. I mean, I've got my adrenaline up a bit thinking about how doctors could contribute to the profoundly good work that UCS is doing, Union of Concerned Scientists, and others. We need to put our heads together, I think. Anyway, look, we've run out of time, Lexi. It's been a wonderful interview, fascinating. To look at the dynamics of the whole thing, both political and scientific and medical and education-wise. And I thank you very, very much for this quite profound insight.
Well, absolutely. It's absolutely my pleasure. I completely agree with you. We need to work together to get the doctors out there.
Yep.
The message is very important, but the messenger is also very important.
Absolutely.
And doctors are a key messenger for making a difference on climate change.
We need to put our white coats on, wear our stethoscopes, and get out there.
There you go. Absolutely.
In fact, here's an idea. With all the demonstrations now happening around the country, get the doctors out in their uniforms so people,
yep,
know.
That's the white coat brigade.
The white coat brigade. Get them out.
I'm with you.
Okay, thanks very much, Lexi.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
My guest today has been Lexi Schultz. Lexi is the Legislative Director for the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program. Thanks so much for listening. This is pretty topical at the moment. Tune in next week for another soul-searing interview, maybe. We'll see. Bye.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.